Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio's Home Edition, recorded on the dates February 4th and 9th, 2021. Well, Ecuador's presidential election is scheduled for February 7th, but with contender Andres Arauz forecast to win big, the government is claiming his party has contravened National Electoral Council rules and could be disqualified. Arauz has promised to continue the Citizens Revolution movement begun by his mentor Rafael Correa and betrayed by Correa's former vice president and current outgoing president, Lenin Moreno. David Adler is a scholar, political economist, and first general coordinator of Progressive International, a new organization saying, quote, "It is time for progressives of the world to unite." Adler is in Ecuador now with a Progressive International elections monitoring contingency. David Adler in the first half. And March 1st, hearings will resume in the extradition trial of Meng Wanzhou, the Huawei executive arrested in Vancouver in December of 2018 and still held under house arrest in that city. Ken Stone is a longtime anti-war activist, serving as an executive member of both the Syria Solidarity Movement and Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. Ken Stone on the arrest of Meng Wanzhou and the new Cold War on China in the second half. But first up, David Adler and Progressive International mobilizing its mission in Ecuador. Stick around. Welcome to the program, David.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's my great pleasure. Of course, now, David, Progressive International says Ecuador's elections are, quote, a tipping point for democracy across the region and around the world. Why, David, is this one election in a relatively remote and frankly marginal country so important?
Over the last 5 years, we've seen the erosion of democratic institutions pretty much all over the world. You know, as you can probably tell from my accent, I'm originally from the United States, which has undergone its own crisis of democracy in recent years, culminating in this insurrection on the Capitol that many of your listeners will know about. But that trend really is global. And so, therefore, you know, the defense of those democratic institutions also needs to be global. I think in the case of Ecuador, it's helpful to really understand it first in a regional context before moving out to the global context. So in Ecuador, we need to expand a bit from this week of electoral observation, which is why I'm here, to understand the last 5 years as being a sustained and grinding attack on these democratic institutions. And that really ranges from what's called legal warfare or lawfare, essentially the criminalization of opposition parties and activists here in Ecuador, culminating in these trumped up charges of corruption against ex-president Rafael Correa, all the way to the signing of an agreement with the IMF for a bailout package in Ecuador, over and above the desires, the wishes, and the popular will against the austerity agenda that's now been driven by the IMF over the past few years. So those are the stakes of this election. And the reason why they're felt beyond the borders of Ecuador is because the same thing is happening all over the world. So in that regional context, we've seen similar tactics of lawfare, certainly in the case of Brazil, against Dilma Rousseff, against Lula, in similar trumped-up charges of corruption. In Bolivia, we also saw this case of legal warfare against Evo Morales and the erosion of democratic institutions and the role of international capital in that process. And then zooming out globally, if we think about the IMF and the role the IMF has played in undermining democratic rights, constitutional rights to health or housing or a decent job, that's happening in Pakistan, that's happening in Lebanon. And so we find here in Ecuador a critical case for making sense of how a popular movement can recover those democratic institutions, can insist on the rights enshrined in its constitution. And we begin from the premise that should they succeed, that can be a ray of hope for so many popular movements around the world who are fighting the IMF, as well as fighting domestic enemies of democracy and reactionary forces organized at the global level. So for all those reasons, we see Ecuador, which is, of course, positioned, you know, here at the top of Latin America, as actually having a resounding impact around the world.
Well, as an American, I'm sure you, as an American rather, David, I'm sure you can appreciate that people in other parts of the world, they might be a little bit wary of people coming in from other countries professing good intentions and getting involved in the political processes there. Can you describe for our listeners exactly who is Progressive International and why should people in Ecuador and in Pakistan and these other places that you mentioned, why should they trust that you have their best interests at heart?
The Progressive International was founded in May 2020, last year, with a mission to unite, organize, and mobilize progressive forces around the world. So we are a common front that includes parties, social movements, trade unions, as well as thousands of activists around the world. And so we are not coming here in a paternalistic fashion. Our electoral observatory is not the type like the OAS who comes and says, oh, we're going to monitor your institutions to make sure you're not breaking any rules that we hold dear. We only go where our members, be they individuals, political parties, social movements that consider themselves part and parcel of this Progressive International, call on us to come to the country, to bring the attention of the international community that we represent, to bring that attention here to this local context. Because it's only under the cover of darkness that so many of these forces of reaction are able to undermine elections, undermine democratic institutions. So the concern that we are here in some, overriding that democratic will really runs counter to our political strategy, which is to be responsive and attentive to the needs and wishes of the very members that comprise this Progressive International.
And you're in Ecuador right now. How is the Ecuadorian government receiving you? Are you being granted, you and Progressive International, being granted access to the polls?
We are here in an official capacity at the invitation of the CNE, the National Electoral Council, and that means that we will be present across the country at local voting stations to make sure that we are not seeing irregularities. Now, we're not alone in this. There are other major teams of international observers who are here to do similar work, and we plan on coordinating with all of them. It's critical that international observers speak with one voice, coordinate their work, because, of course, not any single delegation can be at every single poll station, and it's going to require the shared capacity between those delegations to ensure that those elections are free, fair, and transparent for the international community to see, and certainly for the people of Ecuador. So we are concerned. We've been received, I would say, officially and warmly by some. There are others who are trying to undermine the capacity of international observers to do that work of observation, and that concerns us a lot because, it's less the overriding fear of some grand act like a coup d'etat, for example, than it is the concern a democracy can die a death by a thousand cuts. If there are small chinks in the armor that are being plowed by, certain doubts and accusations and unfounded stories circulating rumors in the media that, for example, international observers come from it with external agendas, that they're coordinating behind scenes with political parties or activists. What that does is it creates a cloud of uncertainty that can undermine the most critical element of a democratic election, which is the shared perception of its legitimacy. So yeah, those are things that hugely concern us. We've been communicating them to a domestic audience here in Ecuador and around the world, those concerns, and they'll remain at the top of the list. But we're confident that we can maintain that spirit of openness and collaboration with all the delegations who are here so that we are actually working as a single team rather than against each other.
Well, I've read the accounts that the National Electoral Council has cited Articles 204 and 278 against the leading party in the polls, the ANAS party, one saying that they were using COVID tests as a bribe. That would have been Article 204. I'm surprised that you would be welcomed so warmly by the same group, the CNE, that are filing these what many see as spurious charges against Arauz and his party.
I think it's critical to understand electoral authorities as being comprised by various different political factions. I think it's not helpful to see the state as a monolith, but to really disaggregate it to understand what's happening inside these institutions. And the fact is that there's a lot of conflict about This is something that's, again, at the top of our list of concerns. A lot of conflict between electoral authorities and certainly within those electoral authorities about what their own positions and priorities should be, about how they should be approaching the question of international observation. There are people who are frankly, openly, and publicly upset that a group like ours that represents so many activists and movements around the world is coming here because they accuse us of bringing with us a certain activist agenda. And there are others who are thrilled to have us because they know that we are going to make this a fundamentally more transparent exercise of popular sovereignty. So it doesn't come as a surprise to us. These are rotating positions inside electoral authorities that are politically appointed. They're not sort of standardized bureaucracies. And of course, that involves a lot of contention. And it's contention that we expected. It's something to observe, to monitor, to make sure it's not bubbling over into major perceptions of illegitimacy in the elections, but it's something that we were prepared for when we came here, and we have to be vigilant and maintain a kind of fortified position that, you know, we're here with the same mission as any other group.
Well, the logistics of pulling off the election have also been part of the concern that things are going to go awry. The COVID-19 epidemic not being the least of those. There's reports from Telesur that PCR tests are being demanded of indigenous or local poll watchers. Are they making those same demands of you guys?
Just a critical update on the question of the COVID-19 local observers, because it was a huge concern for us. Obviously, it would have been an impossible strain logistically and financially on the capacity of local observation, which would have been a huge hit to, again, the integrity of the elections. And it's small regulations like those, as I was saying before, that have the capacity to undermine the entire exercise. So that would be a huge concern for us. Luckily, that rule was scrapped. So that's not going to be demanded of local observers. But yeah, of course, international observers are required to show COVID-19 PCR tests on entry to the country. And so all of us here are, you know, happily COVID negative.
And you haven't had to be quarantined or anything?
No, we have not had to be quarantined. The time was a bit short for that. So we are straight into the observation work. Just this morning, we were off on the outskirts of Quito, overseeing the production and distribution of ballot papers. This has been another source of concern for us. There were a bunch of misprinted ballot papers that had the wrong logo of this party amigo. And so there was a big concern about how those papers were being either incinerated or put into the trash. And it's something that we're following up on here to make sure that, you know, there is real transparency, and we can be assured that the ballot papers are being that they're the right ballot papers, that they're going to the right places. And so that's why it's so important for us to have eyes and ears all over the country.
And are you satisfied that those ballots, because people up here in Canada and the States too probably have a different way of voting rather than having party dedicated ballots printed? And as you say, there's been a printing problem with the one party that says, oh, whoops, we made a mistake on the logo. And then they reprinted the same number of ballots, but then there would be these ballots still in circulation. So that makes ballot stuffing a very real possibility. Are you guys satisfied that destruction of the original run is going completely?
We're collecting observations now. Whether those observations and concerns mount towards a larger, more sustained criticism or, you know, accusation, that's not something that we can even answer now because the work of observation is just underway. But certainly the issue of satisfaction, I mean, it's not a word that we would throw around given how early on we are and how much we're trying to detect patterns before we make a judgment.
Well, another concern I read of was that the printing of ballots didn't begin until just a few days ago. And the concern is that it will be too late to distribute printed ballots to some of the more far reaching areas of the country. What about distribution of ballots and getting proper representation to the hinterland?
Yeah, it's always a concern. I mean, the disenfranchisement of specific populations that are, you know, geographically and socioeconomically marginal is a major concern for us. It's also a major concern because it's unlikely that we, in the size and scope of our delegation, are going to be able to be in those rural areas, far away from the capital, Quito. I think it's, again, too early for us to know whether and how that ballot distribution is going to play out. We remain hopeful that the distribution is going to reach all the corners of the country it needs to reach, and that everyone will be able to exercise their right. But we're keeping a close attention on abstention rates and regional distribution. I mean, we've got a technical team here, and they're keeping a close eye on the relationship between the present vote and the last one, keeping a close eye on abstention rates. Unlike in the United States, there is a mandatory voting in Ecuador, so we can keep very close tabs on irregularities in abstention rates as a mark of kind of disenfranchisement in this way. Even the ballot stuffing will be tracking kind of not just with our eyes, but also looking sort of at the timing of votes to make sure that there are no irregularities there. So it's a big task, and it's going to require us to basically set the groundwork far before Sunday and far after to be kind of sorting through the data and being as rigorous as possible. But I think it's just too early for us to be ringing the alarm on any of these particular issues.
Well, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today to David Adler. David's a scholar, political economist, and he's the first general coordinator of Progressive International, a new organization that says it is time for progressives of the world to unite. He's in Ecuador right now with Progressive International's elections monitoring contingency to watch, as David just said, Sunday's election in Ecuador. You mentioned earlier, David, the OAS, the Organization of American States. Can you describe a little bit of the concern expressed in the article that your organization put out about these elections, the role that the OAS played in the Bolivian elections in 2019, and the worry that the hanky-panky might repeat itself in Ecuador, this especially in the light of the outgoing president, Lenin Moreno, spending a lot of time with representatives and the head of the OAS in Washington, D.C. these last weeks, and I believe he's still there today.
Yeah, I think it's helpful not to mince words here. We are tremendously concerned about the role of the Organization of American States, the OAS, that has it played historically. There's a long record of the OAS playing a pretty desultory and dangerous role in Latin American democracy, and most recently and colorfully in the case of November 19's Bolivian elections, where the OAS was fundamental, if not outright instrumental, in laying the groundwork for a military coup against Evo Morales and the MAS government that won in those elections in November 2019. I think we can be confident enough now, looking back, and obviously from our perspective, from the Progressive International's perspective, we were first in Bolivia to observe those elections and had the opportunity to watch the people of Bolivia mobilize courageously and peacefully to restore democracy to their country after a year of terror under this coup government. But what we were able to see in the aftermath of those elections with our own technical observer team was that every single case that the OAS had claimed marked fraud by the Evo Morales government, because supposedly it was impossible for the MAS to be winning 95-96% of the vote in some of these districts. That was the reasoning that the OAS put on the table for why there had been electoral interference on the part of the MAS, which of course was fuel in the tank of the coup plotters in La Paz, who forced Evo Morales into exile and again laid this groundwork for a very violent and repressive year. Now, if we look back at the 2020 results from October 2020, in the elections that we first observed there, you saw that those precincts getting 95-96% for the MAS, the Movement Towards Socialism, the party of Evo Morales, were winning 99%, 98%, 100% of the votes, as a real middle finger to the role the OAS set in basically attempting to discredit popular sovereignty in those places. So you would have thought that such a disgraceful performance by the OAS would have led to some contrition, maybe even a resignation of Luis Almagro, who heads up the OAS. We have seen no such contrition, no such admission of guilt, and it's to their great humiliation that they have fully discredited themselves as international observers. So we come here, as I said at the outset of our discussion, certainly with the spirit of openness and the desire to collaborate with any and all observers here, but with a tremendous amount of suspicion for the motivations, capacity, and certainly methodological quality of the work of the OAS. And so we're both monitoring the role of domestic actors in fomenting uncertainty and undermining the integrity of these elections. And certainly we're monitoring the role of international observers like the OAS in laying the groundwork for attacks on democratic expression here and the right to free and fair elections of the people of Ecuador.
Yeah, and reading this article in Telesur, a former legislator, Ecuadorian legislator, Mauro Andino, as well as talking about the late ballot printing, and these articles for removal of the Áñez party, he points out that this wouldn't stop the election, but it would invalidate after the fact in case Andrés Arauz's party should take the election, much as in Bolivia when the election went ahead, but after Evo Morales had won the election, then it was invalidated after the fact with the help, as you mentioned, of the OAS and then the United States as well. What about that? What about the American and the other nations within the OAS? What are their views on this candidacy, or are they expressing any?
There's no doubt that the United States plays an outsized role in the OAS, in its governance and its activities, and that means that it's not conspiratorial to think that whatever the OAS is doing has the consent, tacit or explicit, by the government in Washington. Now we have a new government in Washington, that of Joe Biden, and he's made clear that he intends to have a new approach to foreign policy, one that is more accommodating, if not outright promoting of a sort of democratic agenda. Now, how that is being defined remains to be seen, but this will be a critical test case. You asked me at the very outset of our conversation, why is Ecuador important for the world? Well, one of the reasons why it's important for the world is because it's going to be the first test case of Joe Biden's approach to the Monroe Doctrine. What kind of relationship does the U.S. have, is it going to have under Joe Biden, to Latin America and to the democratic dynamics happening, you know, south of its border? There's no doubt that Andrés Arauz and his policy program presents a threat to the international creditor class that is represented by the International Monetary Fund and indeed by the United States government. There's also no doubt that Ecuador, as a dollarized economy that uses the U.S. dollar as its local currency, is closely integrated with the United States in a way that several, you know, other countries which have more policy space from the United States would be less on the radar. So, you know, I think that it's too early to tell what the approach is going to be from the new Biden administration towards the prospect of an Arauz presidency here in Ecuador. But there are good reasons to think that it will be tense and that it would require a great deal of vigilance and solidarity on the part of the international community to say that, you know, what was won in free and fair elections and what was won on the basis of a constitutional right to popular sovereignty here in Ecuador needs to be respected and cannot be actively or even passively undermined by foreign powers like the United States, who might or may or may not have an interest in seeing Andrés's program, potential program to serve the people of Ecuador, you know, turned around or deflated.
Well, and of course, the Monroe Doctrine refers to the 19th century belief that in the United States that Latin America was essentially America's backyard, and that their intervention and their pseudo governance was legitimate. Well, the IMF has the same attitude. I would argue the Ecuadorian government of Lenin Moreno restructured in August $17.4 billion worth of debt and took out another $6.5 billion worth of debt through the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. The leading candidate, Andrés Arauz, he says that he doesn't like the IMF and he was going to give him the boot. I can see that they wouldn't like to be defaulted on. Is that what we're looking at, a defaulting and maybe moving back to de-dollarization and the reintroduction of indigenous currency down there?
Andrés has said very clearly that his plans are to fortalecer la dolarización, which means, you know, to support and manage dollarization in a way that is helpful to working people here in Ecuador. And the same goes for the relationship with the IMF. I don't think that there's any evidence that Andrés plans to be, you know, rash or extremist in this approach. But there are clear things that I think Andrés finds non-negotiable. This question of central bank independence, for example, where the IMF is basically forcing the government of Ecuador to give up its right to control its own central bank in the name of central bank independence, essentially privatizing its own central bank, stripping even more monetary sovereignty away from the government of Ecuador, just as a new progressive government prepares to take its seat. You know, I don't think this is something that Andrés is going to allow. And so there's definitely a showdown that would be on the horizon in the case of an Andrés Arauz presidency with the IMF, because the terms of its agreement with Lenin Moreno are just absolutely horrendous. and do need to be contested by anyone who wants to stand up on behalf of working people here and not the creditor class. But that, I don't think, you know, needs to be framed around this question of major rupture with the international order. It can be framed alongside of, you know, this is a person who's pledged to deliver progressive reform and is going to deliver progressive reform. And, you know, it's not up to the IMF to decide the future of Ecuadorian people, because it's not up to the IMF to write the constitution of this country.
Yeah, I wonder how much power the central bank in Ecuador has when they're using American currency. They can't obviously set the value or manipulate the value of that currency. As far as the United States is concerned, how much do you think, David, that what happened in January 6th with the storming of the Capitol, and the fact that the outgoing President Trump didn't want to go out at all and that he refused to accept the legitimacy of the election that he lost, what kind of example is that setting to countries like Ecuador and others around the world when it comes to democracy promotion?
Yeah, I'm not sure that anyone in Latin America needs the United States to give it lessons in what military coups and other, you know, attempts to subvert democracy look like. There's plenty of recent memories here. I mentioned Bolivia in 2019, but Dilma Rousseff's putsch in Brazil is another recent case of this. You know, so it comes down to exactly this, that the people of Ecuador are just tired of the erosion of their rights that were so hard won by their mothers and fathers and grandfathers and grandmothers. And I think the same goes for the relationship to the United States. You know, there's just there's a sense of deep disdain for the hypocrisy of a country that promoted democracy on the one hand and then was very pleased to allow its own to degrade to the point in which it has. And so I don't think that, you know, people here of any partisan stripe are going to tolerate that kind of hypocrisy anymore as they move to recover their own democratic institutions. You know, just looking to this weekend, I think that we're hopeful that this is going to be a peaceful and fair and free election. We're really excited to be here with the support of the CNE, to be working alongside other official observers. And I'd love to come back on the show sometime, maybe, you know, on Monday to discuss what happened in the course of these elections. And maybe we can digest together whether that prediction of free and fair elections has stood up over the course of this week.
I hope you're right that it does stand up, although if it doesn't, we won't find out immediately because of the CNE. And will they invalidate the election after the fact? Will the OAS pursue that course? Will Joe Biden and the United States new government do the same? Will Canada support an overthrow of a democratically elected government in Ecuador as it did in Honduras? All right. Well, David Adler, thanks a lot. Progressive International, do you want to give us the website where people can go and find out more about the work you guys are doing?
Absolutely. It's just progressive.international. That's the whole URL.
Okay. Well, that's nice and simple for all of us. Thanks a lot, David, for coming on, and good luck, and enjoy Ecuador, I guess. Eh?
Thanks so much. It's great to be here. And yeah, I do hope to catch up soon after we have a better sense of what's happened on Sunday.
Great. Well, I want the rest of you to stick around. Ken Stone will be up in the second half. Thanks again, David.
Are invited to explore the power of plant-based living from the barnyards to the courtrooms and everywhere in between. Listen to Plant Powered Radio every Tuesday 11 till noon on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
Moscow, Tokyo, New York. Guerrilla Radio is everywhere. Online at cfuv.ca, Thursday and Saturdays, and at guerrilla-radio.com. Everywhere, all the time.
Chicago, Jakarta, Helsinki, Cape Town, Sao Paulo, Manchester, Bangalore, and somewhere in
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio's Home Edition, recorded on this date, February 9th, 2021. Well, March 1st, hearings will resume in the extradition trial of Meng-Wan Zhou, the Huawei executive arrested in Vancouver in December of 2018 and still held under house arrest in that city. Meng is also daughter to the founder and CEO of the Chinese tech giant, whose company has been a focus of the growing trade war between the world's two greatest economies. Meng's arrest has thrust Canada into the middle of that global imbroglio, threatening trade relations and damaging the country's reputation as a, quote, rule of law nation. Ken Stone is a longtime anti-war activist, serving as an executive member of both the Syria Solidarity Movement and Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. Ken and the Hamilton Coalition are joining forces with online investigative journalism site The Canada Files to continue the Cross Canada Free Hmong One Joe campaign. Today, Ken Stone on the arrest of Hmong One Joe and the new Cold War on China. Welcome back to the show, Ken.
Thanks, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's my great pleasure to speak with you again, of course. Now, we talked the last time about Hmong One Joe. Bring me up to speed now. You guys are organizing another event in the Cross Canada campaign.
Yes, I'm pleased to announce that the Cross Canada campaign to free Hmong One Joe is having its second panel discussion online, a Zoom panel on Monday, March 1st, 7 p.m., Eastern Time, and the title of it, as you indicated, was The Arrest of Hmong One Joe and the New Cold War on China. And the date of March 1st is significant, as you indicated as well, because it's the date on which the extradition hearings are set to resume in her case. And there's two possibilities. One is that the extradition hearings will go ahead, and so will our online panel discussion under the current title. The other possibility is that in the interim, in the 2 or 3 weeks before March 1st that remains, it's possible that Biden and Trudeau might get together. They already had one phone call. And they might get together and talk about the Hmong case. It may be that Biden doesn't want to be harnessed with this stupid arrest of Hmong One Joe as part of his... He doesn't want to be harnessed with it in terms of dealing with China, perhaps. And he might pull the extradition request. If he doesn't, then it's possible that Justin Trudeau might grow a spine and decide that his acquiescence to arrest Hmong One Joe at the insistence of former President Trump was a colossal blunder that he might want to get away from, and all he has to do is tell the Minister of Justice to end the extradition hearing. So that's why the hearings were put off from January to March, to give the judge did it deliberately to give a chance for an out-of-court settlement or a withdrawal of the case. And so we won't know probably till a couple of days before whether or not the hearings are going to continue, but our event will go ahead. If Hmong One Joe is freed, we will have the event and we'll have it as a victory celebration and talk about how the arrest played into Trump's plans to generate a new Cold War with China. And that's, unfortunately, it appears from Biden's recent remarks and his statement the other day, which is called We're Back, I think. He plans to continue this new Cold War with China as well. His speech was on February 4th, that's 5 days ago, on America's place in the world. And he has some very harsh things to say about China and what he wants to do to contain China. So it's we're dealing here in Canada with this with the fallout of the empire, the U.S. empire, trying to deal with a country that it regards as a competitor and rival, though China would prefer not to be seen as a competitor and rival of the United States. They prefer to work with the United States. It's been useful for them in the last 30 years. They've built up their country and become economically probably the largest trading country in the world now. So the arrest of Hmong One Joe is a feature of the new Cold War on China.
Well, Ken, firstly, I think that we can agree, and probably the Prime Minister would agree too, that he wishes he was Pierre and not Justin Trudeau. But now, I was going to ask you, well, has the Biden administration made any move any move in that direction, that they would be less bellicose with China than the Bush administration or the Trump administration was? But I haven't heard it. If they have done, I haven't heard it. But this whole idea that Canada is following suit, as far as I've talked to many scholars on this, Canada doesn't need the imprimatur of the United States to throw this case out. by all accounts, from all the people I've talked to, this case against Meng Wanzhou is garbage and should never have been brought in the first place. But Canada can the Prime Minister can sign one piece of paper and it's all over. He doesn't seem like he's willing to do that, though.
No, it's absolutely correct that the Extradition Act is so written that the Minister of Justice can prevent an extradition, can refuse to go ahead with an extradition. At the end of the extradition, can refuse to go along with the verdict of the extradition hearing, or at any point in between, during the hearings, he can put an end to the extradition. Because an extradition is a political act. It's not so much a legal procedure as it is a political act, whether or not it's in Canada's interest to render this person to the United States. And it has been absolutely not in Canada's interest to arrest Meng Wanzhou. It's not been in Canada's interest to create a tremendous deterioration in relations with China, such that has resulted in serious harm to the Canadian economy, especially farmers and fishermen. And it's also resulted in a loss of a co-production of vaccines against COVID-19. So there's been all kinds of results, negative results for Canada as a result of the arrest of Meng Wanzhou. And I think that Trudeau would be well advised just to pull the plug before it goes along any farther.
Well, but the possibility of that seems pretty remote. I'm looking at your site or the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War.ca site, and there's a piece on recent posts up there about China baiting in the Canadian media. Canada seems willing, the Canadian government, I should say, and the media have seemed very willing to go along with this China bashing and this new Cold War rhetoric. Again, it doesn't seem like the Canadian government has any desire to make friends with China or to reverse the damage to the diplomatic standing between the two countries that's been caused by the Meng Wanzhou arrest and imprisonment. Farcical, as I said before, it has no real standing in law, and yet the country continues to say that we're a rule of law nation. But this goes hand in glove, though, doesn't it, Ken, with the recent announcement of purchasing warships that are more likely than not to be put into the Pacific to patrol so-called freedom of navigation zones that gird the Chinese mainland.
Yes, there's been a whole number of indicators that Canada, under Trudeau, and even if it were to be Aaron O'Toole or Jagmeet Singh even, these people are all united in their Sinophobia and their hostility towards China. They have arrested Meng Wanzhou on behalf of Trump in order to use her as a negotiating tool, a chip in his trade war with China. But Canada has also meddled in the internal affairs of China by supporting separatism or independence for Hong Kong, which China regards quite rightly as part of its national sovereign territory. Canada is also gone along with these freedom of navigation routes, and Canadian warships tag along behind the U.S. Carrier fleets going through the South China Sea. Of course, if China tried to sail ships between Hawaii, for example, and the west coast of the United States, you know, there would be war. But the United States regards itself as an exceptional country above the international law and can do what it wants, where it wants, using its military might. And they intend to, right now, under Trump, and it looks like it's going to happen as well with Biden, they are reversing with China the one China policy that they had held since 1979, when the United States finally recognized the People's Republic of China. And part of that policy was that they would recognize that there's only one China and it is seated in Beijing, and that Taiwan is a province of China, and that they would not sell excessive arms to Taiwan. They would not encourage its independence, and they would recognize that Taiwan is in fact a part of China. But that's all changed, and when you do that, it throws up red flags in Beijing, and as a result, the Chinese are responding by flying planes close along the Taiwan coast to show that they fully regard themselves as the sovereign power there. But the Canadian government is going ahead, as you mentioned, purchasing more frigates. I think there's about $70 billion worth of frigates, plus, of course, the fighter jets, price tag $19 billion. So close to $90 billion worth of military investments, which are going to be used as part of NATO and as part of the U.S. empire in many operations around the world. But one of them for sure will be, following the U.S. and its so-called freedom of navigation and initiatives to sail close to the Chinese coast and make their presence felt in antique gunboat style. The problem with the military purchases from all, from points of view of Canadians is that at least the peace movement is that the price tag that they're putting out there for these ships and planes is about $90 billion. But that's not the lifetime cost of these things. The lifetime cost will be four or five times as much, around $400 billion or maybe $450 billion. When you spend that kind of money, you are precluding, you are determining, first of all, your foreign policy. These boats are designed to be aggressive, not to defend Canada's coast, but to be aggressive. And so are the planes. You wouldn't need fighter bombers if you're defending your own country. You would look to missiles or drones or something like that. These are offensive weapons, and they are also determining the fact that Canada's ability to fight climate change is going to be strangled, because as Bismarck once said, you have guns or butter. And if you're spending your money on guns, you're not going to be able to have butter for your people. Or to put it more practically, we will not be able to put out the kind of money, and it's according to the LEAP manifesto, it's about $20 billion a year in order to make the changeover to green energy, getting off of fossil fuels. If you're spending that money instead on arms and aggressive arms, we'll not be able to make the transition to a green economy. And we'll probably not be able to finance social programs, Medicare, and so on. So these are serious choices that the Trudeau government is making, and they're making them on the basis of supporting the U.S. empire's design for hegemony in the Far East, around China, to put pressure on Russia in Eastern Europe, and to help the United States in other areas of the world, such as in South America, where we've played second fiddle to their attempts to overthrow governments that they don't like. So that's where we're at with the Canadian government's foreign policy right now. It's a willing ally of the empire, and by doing so, it's limiting our domestic choices of what Canadians want to do and what we want to see for the long term.
Foreign policy isn't just foreign policy. It becomes domestic policy. We can recall about 60 years ago, Eisenhower's farewell speech, and he warned about just such a thing and saying, well, you build a battleship. How many schools does that represent? How many hospitals? If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today to Ken Stone. Ken's a longtime anti-war activist. He's serving as an executive member of both the Syria Solidarity Movement and Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. We're speaking today about the upcoming upcoming Free Hmong One Zhou campaign event that, in coordination with the Canada Files, a great Canadian investigative journalism site. Well, can the these F-35s, in talking about Taiwan, it's very interesting that now, because of a massive failure at the Canadian or at the American tech giant Intel in their chip production, Taiwan is all of a sudden in the catbird seat, producing the kind of chips necessary for the F-35 and for these advanced warships that Canada is so interested in purchasing. These ships that will cost us billions of dollars, but as you said, they're offensive in nature, and both are capable of carrying cruise missiles that can be armed with nuclear-tipped missiles if our overlords, or I mean our cousins down south, tell us that's what they want to do. Well, Ken, there's you mentioned South America. Now there's a lot going on. I've just done shows on the election that's in progress right now in Ecuador. Canada has been a leading voice, to our shame, on Venezuela, trying to overthrow the duly elected government of Nicolas Maduro down there. What are you guys doing over there at Hamilton to keep an eye on South America and what Canada is doing in our names there?
Well, we've been part of bigger mobilizations and bigger actions to confront Canada's dirty role in trying to overthrow several popular governments that are not compliant to U.S. foreign interests, U.S. foreign policy. Our deputy prime minister, when she was global affairs minister, I'm talking about Chrystia Freeland, was one of the proponents of the Lima Group, which was a rump organization with no legal status whatsoever, that recognized Juan Guaido in Venezuela as the legitimate president, even though he was not elected as the president, and he now has no seat whatsoever in the Venezuelan legislative or executive government. And she gave, I remember one day she gave, he came to Ottawa and he was feted there, and Chrystia Freeland handed over $53 million to him from Canadian taxpayers to help finance his attempt to overthrow the Venezuelan government. It came to nothing, and his stature is declining all the time, with the European Union most recently declaring that they no longer supported him. But the Canadian government has numerous sanctions, economic sanctions against Venezuela, and our peace movement, in Canada, we've held demonstrations, we've held webinars, we've had petitions, we've lobbied MPs. I think that we've written letters to the editor and op-ed pieces. I think we've made our views known to Canadians, and I think that it's one of those things where we don't have the ability to finance opinion polls, but my guess is that the government's policy to overthrow the Canadian government's policy to overthrow the government of Venezuela is not popular among Canadians at this point.
Well, I imagine too. Sorry to cut in, Ken. I imagine too, though, that Canadians wouldn't be very supportive of the Canadian government's position on what's going on in Yemen. The American president, newly in, Mr. Biden, has astonishingly said that he would stop arms sales to the Saudis that are inflicting the spear tip in this ongoing atrocity and humanitarian crisis in Yemen. I haven't heard anything from the Canadian government in this regards. They've been selling weaponry to the Saudis throughout, contrary to Canadian law, I always thought, for us to sell weapons to a country in conflict. Maybe I'm being old-fashioned, but have you heard anything, Ken, about the Canadian position on what's going on in Yemen, if they'll follow America's lead on this?
I haven't heard anything in the last few days about our Canadian government ending its arms sales to Saudi Arabia. This all started under Stephen Harper, when he initiated this $15 billion sale of light armored vehicles from a plant, General Dynamics, in London, Ontario. In the 2015 election, when Justin Trudeau was first running for the position of prime minister, he promised to end that sale. But like many of his campaign promises, when he got into office, he reversed it and he continued the arms sale, despite the fact that he was presented with evidence from peace activists that some of these light armor vehicles were being used against civilian populations, even inside of Saudi Arabia, and never mind in Yemen itself. And there was the Canadian government under Trudeau commissioned a study into the problem, and the result of the study was that Canada was going to continue to sell arms to Saudi Arabia, and they were going to tighten up a couple of regulations for future sales, but they were going to go ahead and sell more arms anyway. And I haven't heard any change in that policy. Now, when Biden says that he, and you say, it was quite remarkable, as you said, that he is going to stop U.S. arms sales to Saudi Arabia, and also to stop supporting Saudi Arabian offensive actions against Yemen. Well, we'd like to think that that's going to mean that the Saudis are going to have to end their aggression against the people of Yemen, who have been trying to assert their national sovereignty after taking power away from a Saudi-imposed government back in 2015. But for one thing, we don't know what Biden meant by he would defend Saudi Arabia's sovereignty in case they were attacked, because the people, the Houthi rebels, the Nasrallah movement, has been very successful in Yemen in not only stopping the aggressive actions against Yemen by Saudi Arabia, but they also carried the fight right into Saudi Arabia, attacking refineries not far from Riyadh, actually, dropping bombs on drones on Saudi military targets near Riyadh itself. So it's hard to say in practice what Biden means by ending Saudi offensive military actions against Yemen, but yet defending Saudi sovereignty. And we don't know for sure if there's actually going to stop, rescind the sale, for example, of $500 billion worth of arms that was negotiated by Trump just a few months ago. So the devil is in the details. We don't know how it's going to all turn out. But perhaps we should be optimistic, cautiously optimistic, I think, that Biden wants to wind down this war. And he might be trying to wind it down in order to save Saudi Arabia from itself, because the Saudis have been involved in two losing wars for the past 10 years. They have been financing the war against Syria, which was started in 2011. And they have also waged this war along with the U.S. and with the U.K. against Yemen. And they're losing both wars. It's difficult to lose wars and stay in power. So perhaps Biden is trying to prevent the Saudi royal family from collapse, because Saudi Arabia, with all its oil wealth and all of its real estate and all its money stashed away in London and New York and Swiss banks, is actually in a deficit position now. They're running out of money. They can't finance what they're doing. They haven't even, on the light armored vehicle sales, they haven't actually met their payments for the last several months. What? So these things show that the Saudi government is in real trouble. And perhaps that's the reason that Biden is trying to save their bacon, so to speak.
Well, maybe we can repossess the wheat board then from the Saudis here in Canada. Ken, we're fast running out of time, and there's way too much war and shit going on for us to get to all of it. But I was just looking at your Kashmir Solidarity Day video that's up at the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War.ca site. I've done shows on the Kashmir situation, but there's so much going on, I kind of lose. That that was a few months ago. I kind of lose track. Have you been following the situation in Kashmir?
I have been following the situation, and it's deteriorating all the time. Since the lockdown, pre-COVID lockdown by the Indian government of Kashmir in August 5th, 2019, when they basically annexed Kashmir, removed its special status, and opened the door for migration of non-Kashmiris to occupy parts of Kashmir, the rebellion has increased, the resistance has increased, and so has the oppression of the almost 1 million Indian police and troops inside of Kashmir, where there's only a population of 8 million people. 308 Kashmiris have been killed in that last year and a half, nearly 15,000 arrested, about 1,700 wounded by the Indian occupation troops, women, 103 women sexually abused. It goes on and on. It's a tremendous struggle by the people of Kashmir for their self-determination. They never got a vote back in 1947 when the Canadian general Arthur MacNaughton was in the president's seat of the UN Security Council and passed a resolution demanding that India give the people of Kashmir a referendum on their political future. Did they want to be in India? Did they want to be in Pakistan? India never complied. And so this festering sore has been going on for 73 years, and there have been so many casualties, tens of thousands in that part of the world. And right now, the situation is actually worsening under COVID. So the situation there needs the attention of the world. The world has to use the United Nations as a collective force to force India to give the people of Kashmir the vote, the referendum, the plebiscite that they were promised 73 years ago.
Well, the world needs to pay attention to a lot of things. I've been doing shows on the war in Ethiopia. There seems to be saber rattling from Washington on Syria and even Afghanistan and Iraq, and not to mention the ever ongoing threats against Iran and then China and North Korea and everything else. What a time to be alive. Ken, before we go, can you reiterate, please, the Hmong One Joe campaign and the March 1st details?
Yes, it's going to be Monday, March the 1st, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, an online panel discussion called The Arrest of Meng Wanzhou and the New Cold War on China. And everybody's welcome to tune in. It's free. It'll be on a Zoom, and you can find out the information on our Facebook page, the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, and join the Facebook events page, or you can go to our website, which is hcsw.ca.
Well, Ken Stone, Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War.ca, you guys are doing great work, and something tells me you're going to be busier than ever in these next 4 years. Thanks a lot for coming on and talking to us today, Ken.
My pleasure, Chris.
And I want to also thank David Adler and all the good folks that keep the wheels spinning here at the station week in and week out. That's all I got for this week. Until the next time.